guess we'll start by quickly disposing of this. Is the microphone on? So I guess we'll start by quickly disposing of a good decade or so of work in early work in multi-parameter analysis. So I'm going to talk about very, very quickly run through what the issues are in singular integral theory. So, as I mentioned in the first lecture, we have the definition of BMO, which is simpler to write in the dyadic case. So we take a double Haar series, which is a wavelet basis for LP spaces, and we're going to sum the Haar coefficients of a function taken over rectangles. So I'm just writing this again in the biparameter case, rectangles I cross J contained in an open set. Now the difference between this definition of BMO that you see and BMO in the one parameter setting is that we have to include rectangles contained in an arbitrary open set so that on the other side we can get the measure of the open set. So that's the definition of BMO. And it is dual to the space H1, which can be defined in a variety of ways, using singular integral operators, using maximal type functions, using square functions. So here is, for example, a dyadic square function written out explicitly. And it's so this square function and this non-tangential maximal function in LP defines the space LP for p is bigger than 1. But when you say that they're in L1, then you have a subspace of L1, and that subspace is the Hardy space H1 in this multi-parameter setting. In the continuous case, H1 can be characterized by boundedness of singular integrals as well. So here's an alternative definition of the space H1. It's the space of functions in L1 such that the Hilbert transform in either direction and the double Hilbert transform belongs to L1. So this is the space that is mapped into L1. Now, these are the right spaces in the sense that the BMO space that's defined this way is the dual of H1. And we have a characterization of BMO in terms of a T of 1 theorem, which was proved in Journet's paper, where he extended some of the convolution notions of singular integrals and tensor products to a more general class of singular integrals. Okay, so I'm really not going to say too much about the singular integral theory, which was extensively developed in the 80s and the early 90s. And there's some recent work on BMO and multi-parameter analysis that I won't be going into, but I should draw your attention to because there's a lot of interesting stuff out there. So here are some additional references to work in the dyadic BMO spaces and in multi-parameter BMO spaces that just in the last few years that, I won't be spending any time on, so I want to make sure I point out these papers. Okay, so what I'd like to spend the time today on is a discussion of certain issues in bilinear operators. Because there, even in the simplest case, the tensor product of two bounded bilinear operators, we don't a priori have any bounds on these operators, and sometimes, as we'll see, we won't get any. Okay, so here is the general form of operators that I'd like to talk about in the first part of this talk. So we're looking at essentially a paraproduct. So if you write this on the Fourier transform side, we have an n linear operator, which is given by an expression that looks like this. And now you should recall that when m is 1 here, we're just taking the product of the functions expressed as the inverse Fourier transform of their Fourier transform. So we just have a product of functions here. But in general, we're going to have a more complicated symbol, M. And the question is, when do we get the same kind of LP cross LQ cross LR bounds on this n linear operator that we get, you know, as in the product case. And in the product case, the bounds would simply be 1 over p1, etc., plus 1 over pn equals 1 over p, because this is exactly the LP bounds that a product would satisfy. And the question is, what sort of symbols can you put here to get such a bound? Now, for M in the Kaufman-Meier class, which means that the symbol satisfies these sorts of estimates, it's going to be C infinity away from the origin and essentially constant on dyadic annular dyadic blocks as you get away from the origin. You do have such estimates, and they're true for all p's. For pi needs to be bigger than or equal to 1, but this p can go down below 1. So these estimates are classic estimates of Kaufman-Meier, and later the p was extended below 1 as a consequence of the realization that from some work of Lacy and Tila that you could expect LP bounds also for p below 1. Those are due to Koenig and Stein and Grafakos and Torres. Okay, as an application of bounds like this on multilinear operators, we have estimates like this for Leibniz-type rules on products of functions. So here we're taking d alpha of a product, and so this is going to be a bilinear operator on FG, and we want to get bounds that look like the right-hand side, and to reduce it to the case that we were talking about, the Kaufman-Meier symbols. Well, for certain alphas, you can just look at this derivative. You can divide by c1 to the alpha, c2 to the alpha, and then on this, you're going to put c1 with an f and c2 with a g. More formally, however, you would proceed by decomposing this product of f and g into paraproducts. So that means that you take take a Littlewood-Paley decomposition of f and of g, and you multiply everything together, and certain as you sum some of these paraproducts, you're going to get expressions that involve two of these products having, say, involving functions c with mean value 0 and the other involving an averaging operator. So these are sort of classical paraproducts. So what I'd like to talk about is a bilinear version of this theorem, and also some examples that show that you shouldn't necessarily expect bilinear versions of these theorems in the multiparameter case to hold. So in this case, let's say we have two functions on R4, and we're looking at a bilinear operator, which, if m is 1, this is just the product of f and g. But now we have a symbol, and we're going to think of m as a tensor, is going to satisfy estimates as if it were a tensor product of two classical Kaufman-Meier symbols. So if it were exactly a tensor product, then the estimates would look exactly like this. But it doesn't have to be a tensor product. But this is the sort of generalized estimates that a symbol M would satisfy. So notice that C1 and eta 1 are grouped here, and C2 and eta 2 are grouped here. So this is reflecting this tensor product structure. Okay, but why should tensor products of bounded operators be bounded in this bilinear case? Well, in fact, it's not necessarily so. There was an example that was fairly complicated, that in which the suggestion that this would work was attributed to Meyer in an old paper of Krikalis, and he gave examples of two bounded bilinear operators whose tensor product in this setting was not bounded. What was easy in this case was to prove the boundedness of each one of these factors, and what was harder was to prove that the tensor product was unbounded. Now, there's another example that can be constructed, that shows that you don't get boundedness in this tensor product case where the easy and hard are inverted. So as our example of a bounded bilinear operator, we're going to take the bilinear Hilbert transform. So this is the operator on the written as a double convolution, and this is the operator with written on the Fourier transform side, showing that the symbol is signum of xi minus eta. So this is the operator that was conjectured for decades to be bounded. It was came up in Calderon's commutators, and Lacy and Thiele proved that it was bounded. So this is the hard part. We have boundedness of these factors, and we're going to input these factors. We're going to take a tensor product of these things. So we take a tensor product. So we're going to form a multi-parameter bilinear Hilbert transform, and that means that we're going to look at an expression like this. So now we have this double singularity that's characteristic of the bilinear situation. And so I'm going to show you that this operator does not satisfy any LP estimates. Okay, so the counterexample, interestingly enough, is exactly the same counterexample that Charles Stufferman used to show that the multi-parameter Carlson partial sums operator did not converge pointwise. So there seem to be constant connections between these things, and probably some of those connections are not fully exploited. So the functions are fairly simple, just e to the ixy. So let's input this. Let's just calculate formally for a moment. Let's just input these functions into this expression. Okay, so we simply have to compute that integral. And now the idea is that what happens is you have these nice singularities that simply cancel each other out. So you compute this, and you simply get infinity. And you can quantify all of this by cutting off this function. You can formalize this by looking at cutoff functions and taking n to be sufficiently large. So the bilinear double multi-parameter Hilbert transform is an unbounded operator in any LP space. And a similar construction leads to a simple counterexample of an endpoint estimate of an operator that appears in some multilinear work of Christ and Kiselev. This was an endpoint estimate whose failure had already been observed by Muscala, Tao, and Chila. But if we look at the operator, so this arises in Christ Kiselev, not exactly, because of course they're considering an operator without the Fourier transform, but in L2 you can put the Fourier transform in here, it's the same. And it's this operator which is not bounded. So here's your operator, and it's integrated xi1 less than xi2 less than xi3. So it is similar to an operator whose symbol is given by this expression, in the sense that the difference between this and this is a bounded operator. So this operator, whose symbol looks like this, has an expression that can be realized as in this convolution way. And the counterexample is, again, just an exponential, e to the ix squared for f1 and f3, and e to the minus ix squared, oops, that should be f2, e to the minus x squared for f2, and you compute it same formally, the same way you compute the other, and you get an answer.
Minus C2 plus C3 or something like this.
Right. It has a positive result if it's C1 minus C2. If there's different signs. If there's different signs. Right. So it's... Right. So this symbol is close to this. But, right, if you have different signs in there, then you're going to get an entirely different answer. Right. Right. So it's the ordering, somehow, of these pairs. Okay. So the moral is that tensor products need not be bounded, but they are in the Clayton-Mayer case, and the reason is essentially for experts in the field that everything is lacunary. But let's go through some of this details of how you would try to decompose this into para products and see that these things are bounded. So we're going to look at a discrete model. So the discrete model of this involves the usual tiles in phase space. So we're going to our discrete model involves a decomposition into tiles where we have, so P sub I is an I cross an omega P sub I. So the I's, IPs are all the same. They're dyadic. And omega P sub I is, so there's three choices, and there are two of these choices have Fourier support away from the origin, and one is supported in an interval around the origin. And the idea is that in this expression, two of these choices of phis have mean value zero, are mean value zero functions, and the other is essentially a bump function. Now, if this is the discrete model for the one-parameter Kleiffmann-Mayer, then what we see is that when all LP indices are bigger than or equal to 1, duality allows us to estimate this pretty readily. So let's assume that we've somehow reduced our operator to this discrete model. How do you estimate the discrete model? You estimate it by testing it against another function. So you take P of FG, you test it against an H, and now you get an expression that looks like this. Now, two of these have mean value zero, and one is a bump function. And so that means that two of these are going to result in square function expressions, and the other is going to result in a maximal function type expression. So you insert the appropriate scale to give maximal functions or square functions, and write this as an integral. And let's say that phi p1 and phi p2 and phi p3 are the ones that have mean value zero. Then what you should see is a maximal function appearing on F, a square function appearing on G, and a square function appearing on H. In other words, you formally get, when you take this para product with a symbol that looks like this, and you test it against an H, you formally get a maximal function, a square function, and a square function. And the boundedness of those three operators in the right LP spaces gives you what you need. So the general, so now I suppose you want to get this as an estimate for P's below 1. So you don't have this phenomenon, this duality. You can't test this against an H necessarily and write this out. But there is a substitute for that testing, which appeared in some work of Muscalu, Tao, and Tila, and was formalized in a precise statement in this paper that I'm citing here by Osher, Hoffman, Muscalu, Tao, and Tila. So in other words, if you want to, so the general case for P's below 1 follows from this estimate of L1 cross L1 into L1 half, weak L1 half. And you can test whether something's in a weak LP norm, again, in a certain way. And here's the statement of the lemma that makes the sort of duality type testing argument work in this case. So the following are equivalent. F belongs to a weak LP, and this is for P less than 1 as well. For every set E, a finite measure, there exists a subset, E prime, which has about the same measure, such that when you test F against the characteristic function of E prime, you get this same constant times E to the 1 over P prime. And now, yes, because P is less than 1, P prime can be negative here. Okay, so this is the way you test whether a pair of product ends up in weak LP. You take for every set E, you find this subset, and you do this testing. And then you're left with an expression that looks like this product again, and you have to find a way of making this estimate work in the same way. So that's the strategy. So the strategy is to use that lemma and a certain level set decomposition to estimate the weak LP norm. So you start, so your function H is going to be a characteristic function of a subset. And a subset is going to be, of the set E, is going to be all those points where the maximal function of the characteristic function of a certain set is small. And the set measures the size of the quantities involved that you're going to end up measuring at the very end after you do this testing. Maximal functions and square functions and so forth. Now, in the biparameter situation, what we do is the same thing. We're going to produce the same level set proof, but we have to have a little extra care as well on the error estimates. So in other words, there's two parts to this. There's a reduction to a discrete model. Then there's a division of what's happening in the discrete model into two parts. One should be an error, and one should carry the main estimates. Both require just a little bit of work. So what's happening in the biparameter situation is, again, we have our discrete model. We have inner products with functions, two of which we have inner products with functions which are now themselves products. So each of these phi functions are products of functions in each variable separately. Now remember, in each variable separately, some functions have, two of the three functions have mean value 0, and two of the three functions, and the third one is a bump function, so it's an averaging. So we're going to, in each variable separately, we get square function, and maximal function, but now they may be mixed up. They don't necessarily all fall in the same place. So there are various expressions that could come up that will correspond to having a square function in one variable or a maximal function in the other, and vice versa. And so in this case, you have to make use of some vector-valued maximal function estimates of Pfefferman and Stein. So you're going to start by taking a characteristic function of a set and testing against it. So your expression, you're going to look at the quantities that you expect to end up with and take away the sets where they're large. The sum of the, in the discrete model, the sum of the tiles that occur will fall into two categories. Ones whose intersection with the complement of this set is non-empty, and ones that do intersect it. Okay, so there are two types of sums that arise, and one should be an error, and one should carry the main term. Let's take a look at decomposing the first sum. So we define the set omega j. So this is the level set decomposition. In the end, we're going to end up with maximal function and square function and square function on two of the three variables. We're going to end up with MS, SM, and something MM perhaps. And we're gonna have to decompose these into very, and we're gonna have a product of these things that we want to estimate, but we don't have this duality in LP norms. So we're gonna sort of brute force decompose it into the places where they're approximately sized 2 to the j. So we form these sets that measure the size of all the quantities that come up at the end that emerge, and we divide our tiles into classes depending on whether they belong to some. Oh, I defined, where's Pn? Okay, so if omega j is the set where, let's say, the maximal function of the square function of f1 is bigger than 2 to the minus j, then tj is going to measure the set of, is going to be the set, collection of all tiles that do not belong to the previous step, but whose intersection with omega j is substantial. And the reason that you do this extra, I'm sorry? Yeah, the p's do not appear in the previous step. And I guess, yeah, okay. I think it will be okay, but let's say the union of j minus 1. So p's are, so they appear for the first time in tj, and their intersection with omega j is substantial. And this is a device to be able to replace in the end a sum by an integral. Okay, so we collect together tiles that belong to Tn1 and Tn2 and Tn3 and n1 and 2 and n3 range over various integers, which are in this case positive because we've already taken away those sets. And we test this against an F3. And the idea is, very briefly, the idea is that when we collect all these things together, we can replace the sum that occurs here by an integral. And the integral takes place over complements of certain sets. And the reason the integral takes place over complements of certain sets is that the intersection of those tiles with those sets is substantial. So This is actually a reprise of a certain idea that appeared in a paper by Chang and Pfefferman when they were doing the atomic decomposition for the Hardy space H1 in terms of the square function. It's basically the same sort of level set idea that appears in that paper. And then you want to estimate the measures of the unions of these. So P belongs to the intersection of each one of these sets. Each one of these sets has some size estimate, so you can get a convex combination of them, and you can add up the whole thing at the end. So I just wanted to give you a little flavor for how that went. Let me mention a couple of extensions of this. First, a student of Muscalu has proven L log L, we endpoint estimates for this. So if f and g are in L log L, we get weak type bounds for L one half, John Workman. And Lacey and Metcalf also proved endpoint estimates in BMO. So some of these estimates were known or proven by Journay, but they have a a paper which proves endpoint estimates on the other side. Okay, so then the question is, what lies between Quaisman-Meyer and these biparameter bilinear Hilbert transforms? So on the one hand, you have tensor products which have boundedness properties, and on the other hand, you don't. But you can formulate it more formally using some terminology and ideas that were developed in this paper by Muscalu, Tao, and Tila, in terms of non-degeneracy conditions on the multiplier. So suppose that you have subspaces in Rn, and you have a multiplier m which satisfies estimates that can be expressed as distance to, in terms of the distance to a subspace. And then, roughly speaking, in the dimension, when the dimension of the subspaces is zero, in the Koifman-Mayer case, you have boundedness. And when the dimension of the subspace is one, we're already outside of boundedness. But in between, there may be some interesting things to work out. And I don't think there's any work that I know of on that. Okay, so on continuing the subject of bilinear operators, I'd like to discuss the analogs of the Koifman-Rochberg-Weiss theory for commutators in the setting of this multi-parameter analysis. So here, the theorem of Koifman-Rochberg-Weiss is the following. And this is part of a collection of theorems that go under the category of Nihari-type theorems, which, you know, in the last workshop you just heard about a new one of this type that Eric Sawyer and Brett Wick prove for the Dirichlet space. So the idea is to express the boundedness of an operator in terms of a condition that involves a Carlson measure. And this kind of thing comes up a lot. So let's take the basic instance of this. So here we have a BMO function, B, and we form the commutator of B with, say, the Hilbert transform. Then the commutator is a bounded operator from L2 to L2, and with a norm bound that depends on the BMO norm of B. And also, you can characterize BMO by saying that whenever you have a function whose commutator has this L2 to L2 bound, that function must be in BMO, and this gives a bound on the BMO norm. Dually, you can formulate this by saying that if this is an L2, we can test this against an L2 function. So if we unravel this, we'll get B times an expression that looks like FHG plus GHF. Now F and G belong to L2, so each one of these pieces belongs to L1, and the assertion is that this special combination has better properties. It has a cancellation property. So this cancellation property puts this function in L1. And it's, in the case of the Hilbert transform, it's not hard to see that this function belongs to L1. You take this expression and you rewrite it in terms of projections. And then you'll have a product of projections in one half space minus the product of projections of F and G in the other half space. And you want to test that that's in L1, so you're going to apply the Hilbert transform. And that's a projection operator, and the action on this combination of projections is just a sign change. It's more interesting to see why expressions like this that involve Riesz transforms or more general singular integral operators are bounded. For example, you could take an expression like this, which is a Riesz transform, and you might try to understand why it's an H1 by applying another Riesz transform. But I don't see an elementary argument for seeing that without decomposing the operator in some way. So the full theorem that appears in Koifman, Rochberg, and Weiss says that if you have a Calderon-Zygmund operator of the following form, then in fact this commutator is bounded from LP to LP when you commutate with multiplication by a BMO function, and the operator norm is bounded by the BMO norm. In the special case where K is the Riesz transforms, then you can actually get a lower bound on the sum of these commutators in terms of the BMO norm. So this is this theorem then has a converse. Where did I write? Oh, yeah. Thank you. All right, and as a consequence, this theorem gives what's called weak factorization of H1, which says that certainly every such function belongs to H1, but now we can decompose an arbitrary H1 function into sums of expressions that have this form. One can form a variety of other expressions involving Riesz transforms and Calder-Zygmund operators that are also in H1. This is not the only one that arises, and some others are explored in the paper by Claisman, Lyons, Meyer, and Semmes in compensated compactness. This theorem is not really a case of their results. I mean, because the cancellation condition should be something like take the symbol M and apply it to Xi minus Xi and you get zero, and the resulting bounds should go into H1, but it's still a conjecture. Okay. Well, I mean, you take one of these symbols for which you have this div curl type estimate. Now you say, suppose that M of Xi minus Xi is zero. So in other words, express the cancellation on the symbol, do you get the bound into H1? Okay, so in the Claisman-Rochberg-Weiss proof of the one-parameter situation, they rather heavily rely on the fact that the commutator of a BMO function with one of these integral operators introduces terms that look like this, and that the BMO norm also has terms that look like this. And so somehow there's a a special use of the L1 form of the BMO norm. So there's various difficulties in extending this theorem to the polydisk, which is what I want to explain now. The first difficulty is just the definition of BMO. We don't have such a nice L1 definition. As I mentioned, we define BMO by saying something about sums of Haar coefficients corresponding to rectangles contained in all open sets. And in the continuous case, we're talking about localization, say, on the Fourier transform side. We're using continuous wavelets instead of Haar wavelets. But there's the first problem you can already see in the dyadic case, which is having to deal with all open sets. And there's a second problem that's introduced in the continuous case, which is having to deal with all the tail estimates coming from these Meyer wavelets. Another problem is, well, what are the right commutators? What are the things that should whose operator norm should characterize BMO? And then in addition, the multi-parameter, meaning three or more products, produces even more challenges than the biparameter, because somehow there are various ways of seeing that three factors are harder than two. And then in addition, if you jump from Hilbert transforms to other singular integrals, there are new technical challenges coming from the fact that you can't really work with these projections anymore, and you have to deal with more general symbols. Okay, so let me give you, there's several results that lead up to something that I'd like to explain in a little bit more detail to you. And let me start with this paper by Ferguson and Sadowski. So they explored this iterated commutator. So now let's look at the biparameter situation. We have a Hilbert transform in each variable separately. The double Hilbert transform characterizes the Hardy space H1. The commutators that we're going to look at are iterated commutators. Our function B will be a real BMO product function. So what they did there is they proved Well, they proved an upper bound, and as I've indicated, the upper bound is not so hard because of the projection, because of the interplay of Hilbert transforms and projections. In other words, if you look at this dually, and you look at the same expression that emerges look at this dually, and look at the same expression that emerges when you test against the BMO function. Throw in two L2 functions, and here's your expression. You want to know that that belongs to H1. Well, apply the double Hilbert transform to it, and you'll see that that still belongs to L1. It's always the same. So the upper bound is easy. They also proved a lower bound in terms of a space that we would love to have be the real BMO, which they call rectangle BMO, which is the same condition on BMO, but you don't use arbitrary open sets, you use rectangles. Okay, so this is a start. We have a candidate for the commutators. And we have an estimate that's not exactly, we have an upper bound and an estimate that's not exactly what we want, but Lacey and Terwilliger showed how to exploit that estimate and actually push this theorem to the real product BMO. So they looked at, I missed something on the previous. So the next step was Fergus and Lacey that showed how to exploit this estimate and find that in the biparameter case, we in fact get a lower bound in terms of the real BMO space. And their exploitation of this estimate is something that is a general technique that has seen other applications. So they use the fact that we have a lower bound in terms of the rectangle BMO norm, which we can now assume is very small, or else we're done. And they bootstrap that to a proof, which is non-trivial. The next step was taken by Lacey and Terwilliger, which extended the biparameter Hilbert transform case to the multiparameter case. So again, I said, as I mentioned, there are challenges to overcome, not the least of which is that they have to find a substitute for their bootstrap argument. When you're in biparameter BMO, there's sort of two natural BMO type spaces you can consider. There's the space where you look at the full, all open sets, and then there's spaces where you look at rectangles, and they have some connection with one another. But in the biparameter, in the multiparameter case, Lacey and Terwilliger found that there were many intermediate BMO spaces that were necessary to introduce to do an inductive argument. So, let me just give you a quick précis of this lower bound argument. So here, omega is an open set that realizes the BMO norm. So we start with a function in BMO, true product BMO, whose norm is 1, and we let omega be an open set which realizes this, meaning that the sum of the Haar coefficients for R's contained in this set is about 1. And then we want to prove that this commutator norm is also bounded from below. Okay? So to estimate this commutator norm, so here's our iterated commutator, they need to find the right function to test this against to show that there's a lower bound. So as a natural candidate, they're going to use the projection of the BMO function into the open set where its BMO norm is realized. So they're going to separate, so the rectangles are separated into two pieces, ones that are not contained in some larger omega set. We're going to try to separate O from its complement by some intermediate step. ours that are not contained in some enlargement, and then there's separate cases corresponding to these. So what they found was a way of estimating these two pieces and using and using an intermediate BMO space and various variants of Journet's lemma to do this. So let me say something about that. In this paper, the key idea was to find the right inductive scheme, which replaced this setup in the two-parameter space. And for that, they needed to introduce these intermediate BMO spaces. So let me just say what they are in n parameters. So you have a product of n, you have r cross r cross r n times. You have rectangles, which are then n-fold products of intervals, and those determine open sets. But you can look at an n minus 1 dimensional version of these things by taking all rectangles contained in an open set with a fixed side length. And so the other side lengths vary. So that gives you an n minus 1 dimensional BMO space. And that is what they used in their inductive step. Okay, so finally, we've put an end to this madness, I think, by proving the Kaufman-Rochberg-Weiss result in products Rn1 cross Rnk for, first of all, proving the upper bound for a family of singular integral operators, and the lower bound for iterated Riesz transforms. So if the soup over all possible iterated Riesz transform commutators is bounded, that soup is a number which bounds the BMO norm from below. So in other words, in the case of these iterated Riesz transforms, you can characterize this. So in this theorem, we faced all of the previous difficulties of dealing with the multi-parameter situation with these inductive estimates, but also now the fact that we don't have this exact correspondence between Hilbert transforms between singular operators and projections. And so maybe I'll just give a few of the main ideas. Okay, so the main idea to start with is to decompose a commutator. So let's just go back to the one parameter setting momentarily, because we're just going to try to find a method that somehow extends. It's to decompose this one parameter into a sum of pair of products. And the idea for an upper bound for decomposing a commutator into a sum of pair products appeared, that this is an approach that appeared, as far as I know, first in a paper by O'Shea and Michael Taylor, in which they extended the Kaufman-Rochberg-Weiss theory to certain pseudo-differential operators. Okay, so let's just look at these pair products. Let's just see how this works in theory. So if you're in R2, your wavelet basis has three main characters which conspire to be a basis of your space. And let's just imagine we're going to decompose everything in terms of wavelet bases for now that are discrete, so that we can see what's going on. But as I said, when it's not discrete, we have all these tail estimates to deal with as well. So we can write F as a sum of pieces delta JF, where the delta J's correspond to wavelets on cubes of size 2 to the minus J. And then this commutator, so what you do in this commutator is you simply decompose your F and you decompose your B, and you get a sum of wavelet pieces. And you wanna essentially analyze that sum. So what you need to do to analyze this sum, essentially, is to apply the singular integral operator, or you apply your singular integral operator to wavelet pieces. So that pushes the singular integral operator into the wavelet wavelets. And in the continuous case, this is not perfectly localized, but in principle and morally, the singular integral operator applied to a wavelet is just another kind of wavelet. Okay. Let me say just a few words about the lower bound. So the essential difficulty in the lower bound, in the setting where you have a multi-parameter situation with Riesz transforms or more general singular, well, with Riesz transforms. I'd like to know if there's other forms of that. But in the setting where you have Riesz transforms, and the essential, one of the difficulties is you have to get an expression for a lower bound for these iterated commutators where you do not have this perfect correlation between projections and the Fourier supports of the rectangles that occur in that decomposition. And so what we need to do is introduce some auxiliary operators that mediate between these half-space projections and the things that you can obtain by taking polynomials in the symbols that occur in the Riesz transforms. So we need to build some operators that are essentially projections into the half space by means of these, whose symbols can be formed from repeated commutators with these Riesz products. So our setup is as in Lacey and Ferguson to take a function in product BMO of norm 1, so let's just look at the biparameter case for the moment. A function in BMO with norm 1, realized by a sat omega, and whose rectangle norm is small. So more generally, we'd be looking at some intermediate step. So the mediating operators that we form are going to be smooth versions somehow of projections onto cones. So we have our BMO function, and we would like to show that this iterated commutator has a lower bound. If T is any polynomial in Riesz transforms, it suffices to show a lower bound for iterated commutators with T in there, because this can be reduced to the iterated commutators involving the Riesz transforms. So our cone operators are going to be bounded operators because they're cones whose boundary is essentially cut off by Fourier projections in half spaces. So the boundary of the cone is going to be just a cube. Well, we're not actually going to take cones. We're going to take smoother versions of these. We're going to smooth out these cones and create some singular integrals that correspond to these. And we're going to introduce a norm, which we call the cone norm of B, which involves the soup of iterated commutators of B with these singular integral operators associated to cones. So these are almost projections onto cones, and the cones are going to be very large, so they're almost projections onto half spaces. So it's a non-trivial step to verify, even in a one-parameter case, that you can compare the BMO norm, the regular BMO norm, with these cone norms. And this is in a paper by Lee. Now, the proof in the multi-parameter case of the lower bound uses an inductive step, which is essentially the same as at Lacey and Terwilliger, although again, because of these recent cone norms, we have to introduce this extra step of first bounding the analog of getting a lower bound on the rectangle with the rectangle norm. So we want to get a lower bound for the Riesz commutators in terms of a rectangle BMO norm, but also we want to get a lower bound of the cone norm in terms of a rectangle norm. Okay, so then we make projections into cones, and we make an assumption that we have small t T-minus one-dimensional BMO norm, we find an open set that realizes the product norm, and now we have to to see what the action of these cone norms are on B. So I sense, as I'm running out of time, that this is too fast anyway, so let me just give you the punchline. The idea is that we can prove that, so these are iterated commutations involving singular integrals associated to cones, that this expression is large, and that when you put in B minus B omega, when you put in the projection, it's large, and when you take out the projection, it's small, essentially. Okay, so I don't advise reading the paper, but that's the end of the proof. All right, I'm going to stop here, and tomorrow I'm going to continue with an entirely different vein, talking about some things that involve nice pictures and intersections of sets. I'm going to talk a little bit about differentiation problems in the multi-parameter setting and maximal functions. Okay, thanks a lot. I alluded to
a problem where you group together the transformed active number variables rather than separating them all the commutators.
So I was wondering whether you could replace the lower bound for Riesz transforms by more general singular integral operators of Uchiyama type. In other words, what is the most general theorem that you can have in this flavor where you get a lower bound? I mean, the Riesz transforms are special, but there must be very general classes out there for which you can say that there's a lower bound. Maybe that was. Well, I guess there's versions of these results whenever you have a Hardy space theory in terms of the setting. So I think that there's probably natural questions that you can ask on the Heisenberg group and for flag singularities and things like that related to these sort of the commutators of multiplier operators. But I haven't actually thought about that, but it might be kind of interesting to do. Han and Guozhen Liu just recently developed a Hardy space theory for these multi-parameter flag singularities. So there's some natural avenues after that. There also should be a Hardy space theory associated with other dilation families. So I'm going to say a little bit more about that tomorrow. So these are product spaces built out of boundedness of operators, square functions, singular integral operators that are invariant under n independent dilation families. And you could look at different dilation families, different groups, and get different spaces. And some of these actually occur in real life, and so their Hardy space theory would be interesting.